Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Attention all units. We've got our sights on a new episode of Andor. We're going to need some recon on this.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Mission's all yours, Squadron Leader. To anyone else on this comm link, send all transmissions to andor@thelorehounds.com and get Holocron bonus episodes for 10 credits with our season pass in the show notes. Rebels, may the Force be with you.
Hello, citizens of the Lorehounds Republic. The Rebellion is being televised, and we're here to analyze every twist and turn as it's revealed in Season 2 of Andor, one episode at a time. So we have a squadron setup going on this season, since they're dumping all the episodes at once, well, 3 a week for 4 weeks. So the first episode of each week will be covered by the Django Squadron, led by John, this week joined by co-pilot Marilyn. And the third episode of the week will be covered by the Delta Squadron, led by David, with Ron as his co-pilot this week. And today, episode 2 and the middle episode of each will be the Echo Squadron. So that's piloted by me. Hi, I'm Alicia. And my co-pilot for this and for next week is Ian from Captain's Pod. Welcome.
That's me. Hello. And Echo is my personal favorite squadron title. So I'm glad we're in Echo Squadron.
I like it, but I am, because my name starts with an E, which is why it is Echo. I feel like I'm predisposed to like Echo.
Oh, you have a bias. That makes sense.
So today we're going to be talking about Sigrona Tima, and this is episode 2 of season 2. And there's also going to be, by the way, lots of little extras coming for subscribers and season pass holders, from the Rebel Squadron Radio timeline briefings to the Holocron Lorecast. So stick around until the end to the outro for a bit more information about what that entails. But Ian, thank you for joining me this time. You are known most of all as a Star Trek lover. That's what you cover on Captain's Pod.
Don't tell them. They'll kick me off the show. It's a secret.
Did you just get lost and wander into the wrong podcast now?
Yeah, I switched my warp drive for a hyperdrive and ended up in an alternate universe. My one big main love has always been Star Trek, but I think it's fairly impossible to avoid Star Wars in some form. So, of course, I have a huge love for Star Wars as well, and it's fascinating to see the comparison between the universes of Star Trek and Star Wars in the 2020s and how there are varying levels of quality in the content that's being put out.
Well, that's true. I mean, because they are both big sandboxes that various writers and creatives can play in with varying success.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good diplomatic way to put it.
Were you born into a Star Wars household, or was that something you picked up on your own along the way?
No, absolutely. We're mainly a Star Trek household, but there was love for all of the stars. There was Star Wars, Stargate, Starship Troopers. There's all of it. So I probably watching the original trilogy, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, A New Hope, that would have been with my dad for sure. He was definitely he's the Star Trek man, but he's the Star Wars guy as well. So I never really had that divide in my house where like, it's not like a sports team thing. It was like, no, this is a Trek house, not a Wars house. It was very much all of the stars are welcome under this roof.
Okay, that's fair. That's very diplomatic, as the Star Trek and the Jedi would approve.
Oh, absolutely.
And Mon Mothma.
Very much.
Do you have favorites? I mean, I know you were, when we were talking about scheduling for Andor, you were like, hey, I can take on another one. You know, you're obviously keen on this show. Mm-hmm. Is this your favorite Star Wars?
Yeah, this is my favorite TV Star Wars for sure. Aside from animation, because that's like a different bucket for me. Like Clone Wars is just a beast in and of itself. And I haven't even finished it all. It's something I've only picked up in the last couple of years. But yeah, in terms of the live action shows, season one of The Mandalorian was great. Loved it. Season two, cool. I'm drifting a little bit away now, but Andor is what I wish Star Trek was doing as well. It's like, just hold this show up, and just, this is the example of how you can do big space opera with heart, with stakes, with great writing, with great action, sets, costumes. Just look at this before you start doing anything else, regardless of what your story is. So yeah, Andor is just, it's operating on a different level to a lot of what the a lot of the other content that I'm seeing in either sandbox from Star Trek or Star Trek or Star Wars.
Yeah, it is. It's a very mature Star Wars, which I know a lot of people recoil from, but I love personally, like, the last three Star Wars shows are probably my three favorites, like this, The Acolyte, and Skeleton Crew. And they are just also different from each other in tone and setting and, you know, what they're trying to get across. Although they do feel, to me at least, very much like different parts of the same world. And I just love Star Wars is one of my like top three worlds, along with Wheel of Time and Marvel. And I just love the fact that there's, you can do so many different things, you know?
Yeah. It really is a gifted time to be a Star Wars fan, a Star Trek fan, a genre fan in general, because there really is this willingness to expand into different genres and really use it as the sandbox it is. So the most recent iteration of Star Trek was Section 31. Absolutely, probably objectively terrible, but I am so glad it exists, because it is a swing that I can't imagine Star Trek taking 20 years ago. And it's the same for Star Wars. Even the stuff that misses, I'm glad it exists. I'm glad it's out there doing different things. One of the things I'll need help from you with is the timeline stuff. So I get confused about where I am, which trilogy I'm in, and I'm sure that'll be sacrilege to Star Wars fans. But
no, it's confusing. But that's why I have the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast. See the link tree in the show notes.
Yay! Look at that segue. Look at that.
Although I'm still only on the third era there, the High Republic. So there's a lot of content to get through.
So much content.
But have you seen Rebels, the animated series, or were you waiting until after you finished Clone Wars to watch that?
Yeah, so this is what inspired me to do that, was I decided to go back to, so a couple of years ago, episode one returned to my local theater. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch The Phantom Menace. People will not agree with me on this, but it's one of my favorite movies. I love the diplomacy. I love the Senate chats. I love all of the sneaking around and all of that stuff. And anyway, so I love The Phantom Menace. I watched it in the theater and I thought, this is a great time to go from this point onwards and carry on. So I watched Attack of the Clones. We'll move on from that. And then I was about to go into Revenge of the Sith, and I thought, hang on a minute, there's some stuff between this, and there's a lot of Clone Wars that happens. So that's when I dove into that, and then I'll do Rebels. And I did feel...
And Bad Batch in between.
Yeah, all of that as well. Oh my gosh. And I wish I'd managed to get to it before watching Ahsoka, because I did feel a little bit left out, but I love that show so much. That was another one that just absolutely ticked my boxes.
Yeah. Ahsoka was essentially like a sequel to Rebels, but also Rebels is happening concurrently with Andor. So I do wonder if we're going to get a crossover. If so, it would most likely be in the third week.
Oh, that would be incredible. I mean, it would be incredible for everybody that has seen Rebels. I will nod and enjoy it for what it is.
Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, if you see them, because Mon Mothma shows up on the rebel ship in the third, on like the Ghost, the ship of the rebels crew, the Spectres, in the third week. So yeah, we'll see.
That's incredible. That would be a lovely tie-in.
Yeah. But also I have to say, people who enjoy listening to Ian today, we've also been covering new Who together on the Sonic Screwcast, also found in the main Lorne Howds feed. So you can check out more of that. I think you might not have time to join this week, but we're going to do a quick recording.
Yeah, sadly, I can't this week. My TARDIS is malfunctioning and it's stuck somewhere else at the minute.
Yeah. But let's get into Andor itself. And just a quick rundown of the spoiler policy. Basically, everything is on the table except for we will not spoil episode 3. I've watched episode 3. You've probably also watched episode 3.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But we've not watched past that and we will not be spoiling any plot lines there. We're just setting it up. But Rogue One, anything from the books, comics, films, TV shows, all on the table.
Sounds good.
Ian, what did you think? Well, what did you think of the first two episodes, but with a focus on this second episode?
Man, episode 1 was incredible. I was captivated from the very first set that we see, just that stark white room with the experimental, is that TIE Avenger? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just incredible. The episode had me the entire way. It was a 1 year later, it can be a little bit jarring sometimes, but it did a great job of getting us back into where everybody is. And that passage of time really needed to happen. And I think it's a really smart way to handle the build up to Rogue One, especially since we're going to be rapidly accelerating towards it. Episode 2 was a little bit of a slowdown for me, but I still had a great time with it. I am yearning to be with Mon Mothma as much as I possibly can and just keep Luthen on screen as much as possible. I think there's just a little bit that dragged it down for me was Cassian being literally stuck in the mud for an entire episode. Killed the momentum a little bit for me, but overall, I still had an absolute blast with it.
Yeah, it seems to be the general consensus that Cassian stuck in the mud is the least favorite plot line, and Chandrila, yeah.
Yeah.
They were pronouncing it Chandrila,
which is something.
Yeah, but no, it's Chandrila.
Yes!
But that seems to be most people's favorite plot arc of this first batch of episodes. I mean, it's the middle episode, and I have a feeling it's gonna have middle episode syndrome all the way through for probably where it's moving the pieces basically from episode 1 to episode 3. But
yeah,
digging into it, there are a lot of interesting character moments and minor reveals and important setups and things like that. So it's good that we are getting into the details. Yeah, so this is season 1, episode 2, Sagrona Tima. And the writer of this whole block of 3 episodes was Tony Gilroy himself. Who is the showrunner creator, for anyone who might not know that. The director for this whole block is Ariel Kleiman, and he doesn't have the deepest portfolio. He did a movie called Partisan in 2015. I think it's a French movie. He did an episode of Yellow Jackets, season 1, episode 8. So it's interesting that he's so good at directing, it seems, based on these 3 episodes. Of course he should be.
Like, this is the, if you're going to call anything the flagship. No, I guess Mandalorian would probably be the flagship at the minute, but
sure.
In terms of like prestige Star Wars, Andor is, they know it.
I mean, Andor basically corners the market on prestige Star Wars. I'm not sure if anything else really qualifies.
No, I think that's fair.
Maybe Rogue One, maybe. you asked about the timeline, so I'm sure there's lots of people who want to know. This is for BBY, this batch of episodes. So we're going to be jumping forward a year, each batch of episodes. So that means that this is 4 years before the events of the original movie, and BBY means Battle of Yavin, before the Battle of Yavin. And Yavin, yeah, that's the big battle at the end of the first movie, basically. Mm-hmm. And keep that name Yavin in mind, because we'll mm-hmm. be talking about it this episode. Big reveal. But of course, yeah, they weren't calling it that in that time, because they were not referring to a battle that had not yet taken place.
It's so strange. So yeah. Weird.
So by their dating system, it was year 31 of the Great Resynchronization. And the title, it's a common toast in Chandrila. And it was just introduced for the first time last season in Andor, the Sagrona Tima.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything else when I did a bit of digging. It seems to be the origin.
Yeah. Yeah, so we see throughout, you know, someone says Sagrona and the other person responds Sagrona Tima. And when Perrin gives his speech, he seems to suggest that Sagrona means welcome. Sagrona Tima means like a toast to your health. And he also says Sagrona Tima Salom, which is like a single truthful insight. I don't know. It's interesting. I would love to hear more of this Chandrilan language fleshed out, because they all are just speaking in basic, which is English.
Yeah, I always have a huge amount of respect when a language is introduced. Something mm-hmm. Star Trek does a huge amount, and when Star Wars does it, it's always captivating. And it's just to get the sibilance and each, when you know that you're hearing an alien language and it's distinct from another language, it's just a level of care that is, you know, I'm always in awe of. And yeah. Of course, there's so much meaning that you can read into it, especially, and we're not at that point yet, but so much you can read into his speech and who he's delivering it to and the way in which he's delivering it.
Yeah, I'm always so jealous of the people whose jobs it is to just come up with these languages for TV shows, you know, yeah. Like coming up with High Valyrian or Dothraki. Oh, or, yeah.
It's beautiful.
It would be really fun for my puzzle brain.
Yeah, or it would be absolute torture, one of the two. It's like, no, yeah, that doesn't work both. In that way.
But that's the thing. It's like I don't know if you ever do any coding, but it's like you get something's not working and it's absolute torture. And then you fix whatever little wrong space there was, or, you know, or like a comma somewhere, and you feel godlike.
Yes. You've hacked the matrix.
Mm-hmm, exactly. All right. Let's get into the episode. We're going to go plot arc by plot arc. And so that means we're going to talk about events somewhat out of order from the episode, and we're going to start with the Imperial Love Nest. So first,
I love that name for it.
So first we've got Dedra Mira. She returns from her ominous meeting with Krennic and crew at the Malthine Divide. That happened last episode. And she was asked then to join the conspiracy to find a good reason to crush the Gorman people so that the Empire can strip the planet of its minerals for its so-called sustainable energy project. And Dedra confesses now to her boss, Major Partagas, that she's not sure she wants to be a part of this whole thing. But he tells her that whatever Krennic says is not an invitation, it's a command. Partagas says it will look like a demotion, a punishment for wasting time and resources trying to hunt down the rebel leader known as Axis. But if she plays it right, it's Dedra's chance for advancement. Krennic, he points out, likes the way that Dedra plays fast and loose with the rules to get things done. So question for you, Ian, do you think that Dedra didn't want to do it for moral reasons or just because she would rather be spending her time in the Axis situation?
Matt, there's always this temptation to find the moral core even in the villains and to mm-hmm. maybe have this twist that it's fun to have that twist that somebody's going to turn good and join the rebellion in some way. But no, I think she is 100% dark side. I think she has her own moral core, and I believe what she thinks she's doing is moral, but I don't think it would be, it would line up with most people's version of morals. So my instinct here is that this plan, like nobody in that room seemed very excited about the Gorman plan. And the way we've seen Dedra act is very much from the shadows, and we see that with Krennic when he has to pull the plan out of her, and he's mm-hmm. like, I know you've already got a plan, and I know that you're trying to be clever by hiding it. She doesn't like to be in the light, and this Gorman mm-hmm. plan, is a huge, huge swing. And if it goes wrong, everybody behind it is exposed and in the sunlight. And I just don't think she wants that. While she probably agrees with the end goal, I think she'd like to see other people do it. And she kind of works in the shadows. I don't think she wants to take the lead on this, especially with the high chance of it going wrong. I mean, after being burned on Ferrix. Especially after being burned there, I think she's extra cautious about what her next move should be.
I agree that she's not like, oh, I want to be a leader and I'm looking to be recognized, although it was a plot line where she was looking to be taken seriously, which is really as a woman in a sexist empire.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that she really had to fight to get them to listen to her. But I think her motivation is, I don't think her motivation is recognition. I agree with that. I think it is actually getting things done. But in getting things done, I've noticed that she doesn't mind making a stink that draws attention to herself.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder if she's learning from that. I wonder if that, the stink that she had in season one, I wonder if she's learning and growing from that. And that's why she's picking this next move more cautiously. Or it could also be like, I don't like to be strong-armed into anything. Like, if I'm going to make this move, I want it to be because of me. And Krennic and Partagaz have made it very clear that she doesn't really have a choice on this Mm-mm. one. You just got to make the best of it. That doesn't strike me as something she... it's not her favorite position to be in.
No, she definitely doesn't like to be controlled. But I mean, a part of me is always going to want to see maybe room for morality, room for doubt.
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case. I will hold my breath and give her that chance until it happens. But I do think that, I don't know, that she the whole thing with Axis, it's personal to her now. The fact that he keeps escaping her, the fact that he keeps making her look bad, I think she doesn't want to let that go because she hasn't finished it. And it feels, like something that's hanging over her, something that she wasn't able to win.
Oh, I think that's a great point. I think that's probably, if what I said was like 50% of it, I think that's 150% of it because she's operating way beyond 100%. I think she's taking that very personally. If there is some permutation where she can catch Axis in the act, it redeems her screwing up in the last season. Like everything that she's been demoted for now comes around and she doesn't see a path to do that through the Gorman plan. Like how is this going to get me to Axis? Like this is just going to put me back a couple of years and he's out there doing whatever, or the group is out there doing whatever they're doing.
Right. And just in case it's not clear to anyone, Axis is Luthen. Of course, she doesn't know that, but we as the viewers do. I like Partagaz's point. Next time, catch them first, then make them famous.
Don't make martyrs out of them unless they're actually dead. Like, you've done everything you could have done.
Yeah, especially now he's probably even more, you know, of a hero amongst the rebels, because if the Empire's looking for Axis, Axis is the dude.
That's the one, exactly.
I just want to point out that the energy project that they were talking about at that meeting, I posted about this in the Discord, but just to add to what John and Marilyn were saying in episode one, it is actually in Catalyst Rogue One, you read about how Galen Erso was hired, or basically he was put on this project that's supposed to be Project Celestial Power. And he actually really thought, because he worked with Kyber Crystals, and he really thought it was about harnessing celestial power as sustainable energy for planets recovering from the Clone Wars. He found out by now, he obviously knows, everyone around that table knows, but the public does not know this is actually the Death Star project. So it's just a cover.
What I absolutely love about Star Wars that is missing in great amounts with Star Trek is the incorporation of literature and the books. So am I understanding a lot of the Star Wars expanded universe, the books are considered canon and they're like incorporated into the movies and the TV shows, or is it kind of a little bit yes and no?
Well, so it was a controversial thing, but there is a clear distinction. So basically before, I believe it was like April 2014, I think, when before that point, basically George Lucas did not have any oversight into the other books and things that were being written. And he would say himself, like, you know, my story is the movies. That's
right.
That other stuff is kind of fan fiction in a way, but not, yeah. I don't think he exactly used those words. But, and then he handed the torch over basically to Dave Filoni, as it would eventually come to be. And they decided at that point, anything written before that point was now considered extended universe or legends. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were really upset about that because there's a lot of great stories from then. And right. then after that point, there would be central supervision over, you know, what books and things were written and right. what stories were in them so that it was more cohesive, although they retcon each other all the time.
Of course.
Like that in Rogue One, Jyn has this kyber crystal pendant. There's three different books with three different origin stories for that necklace.
Oh, that's incredible. But I kind of love the idea of calling it legends because they can all be true. Right. They can all be interpretations.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah. And then a lot of the things from Legends, a lot of like the biggest, most popular ideas or plot lines or things like that are being taken into what is now canon. So we're getting it confirmed here. So.
Oh, I love that so much. Star Trek tends to do the opposite. It's like, was it in a book? We're going to actively try and decanonize that as quickly as possible. But whenever I watch Star Wars and I read about it online, I see a lot of incorporation of like am I right? Thrawn came from a book and then mm-hmm. was animated. And mm-hmm. like, that's incredible to me. Like, I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they ended up having, so that was a case where Timothy Zahn wrote this really popular trilogy and some other books as well that are now considered legends about Thrawn. And so that was the basis. And then, they brought him into Clone Wars and Rebels. And sorry, Rebels, they brought him into, he's mm-hmm. not in Clone Wars, is he? I don't think.
If he is, he isn't yet.
Right. No, I don't think so. I think it's just Rebels. And then they had Timothy Zahn come back to write new canon books about Thrawn.
Oh, it's just incredible. And now we have live action. It's
Live action. Yeah. All right, let's switch our focus to Dedra's partner in love.
This is where the English language doesn't have enough words for love. Because this is a type of love. And we just don't have a word for it in basic.
I mean, I don't know. They seem legit in this completely first part. Agree. We'll see what happens. Let's mm-hmm. see what happens. But so Cyril Karn, he's thriving in management at the Bureau of Standards after his uncle Harlow got him hired there as a lowly minion in season one. When Cyril heads home, though, we find out he is now living a life of luxury with Dedra Miro. In the year since he rescued her from the rebellion on Ferrix, they have become an official couple and moved in together. And now it is time for her to meet his mom, something Cyril would prefer to put off. But it looks like the dinner is set for episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they didn't actually say that this was to meet his mom, but I immediately was like, this is to meet his mom.
I mean, who else would it be? Yeah,
that he's dreading. Yeah,
it has to be. Guess who's coming to dinner? It's just everybody's worst nightmare. Strangely, the most relatable feeling from two of the most unrelatable characters.
I mean, that is the thing. It's like, this is somehow one of the most charming plot lines so far. The villains, I think, right?
What are you
villains?
Doing to us? What's happening? I love it. Keep going.
Wait, so I have a question. So you said Dedra, she is just, you think she's dark side till the end. Cyril, do you see any hope for him?
If you gave Cyril a Rubik's Cube, he would be happy. I feel like he is morally absent. Like I think he is a complete victim of circumstance and would be dogged and determined whatever you put in front of him. And that's kind of exemplified mm-hmm. by our reintroduction to him and his version of passion when he's describing what he does to the new guy that he's talking to and like how he has excelled and how he uncovered. Right. The buyers that are misappropriating they're misappropriating.
I have the exact speech in the notes if you want it. So he basically gives the same speech he got in season one, but do you want to read it?
Oh, I would love to. I was given a position in fuel purity, just over there. I found an entry on a Varnesian input account that didn't match. 200 Coven charging rods. Doesn't seem like much, does it? Well, I walked it back every shift. I'd make my time for my quote to dig just a little bit deeper. Then one day, after months of searching, screens started lighting up across the room. I had uncovered a cabal of corrupt purchasing agents who were stealing Imperial supplies in four sectors.
Four?
Thing, the most mundane thing you can think about. And he's just taken great pride in it. And that really sums him up for me. Like, organize all of the cereal that you have in front of you in by size, and it has to be all within a millimeter of each other. And a year later, you come back, and he would give you an intense story about how he overcame the granola and savored the victory. So I struggle to find or get invested in whose side he's on. He is on the side of the puzzle. He wants to complete the puzzle. He wants to. He wants to be the smartest person in the room, and he has to feel it. And I feel like that's why he's a great pairing with Dedra, because she has a similar struggle as well. Like, they're both trying to prove themselves. They both have this challenging background. Tyrell has the advantage of being a man, so he doesn't have that battle. But they've both made mistakes in season one that they are now clawing their way back up from. So they're a fantastic pairing with a great setup to their relationship.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you're right that they both are attracted to order, and being attracted to order, well, that's the fascist side, you know, that's, it makes it harder for you to, it doesn't make it impossible. Certainly people can overcome their attraction to order with morality, but you know, we saw the ultimate of what the opposite looks like with Fiddle and Faddle Crew in the jungle. we'll talk about that at the end, but
it's beautiful. The juxtaposition between it, my, even though it's my least favorite part of episode two, the comparison between those two plot lines, the juxtaposition is chef's kiss. Fantastic about what is wrong with the Empire's way of doing things and what's wrong with the Rebellion's way of doing things in these early stages.
Yeah, I agree. I would love to see Cyril and Dedra now in that position. I hope that they do that to them.
I love it. I would too.
But yeah, so just a couple, like, people were looking up Easter eggs in Cyril's speech. Varnesian doesn't seem to mean anything. It could be from the planet Varn, which is a watery planet that's associated with Lando Calrissian later. Korvarn energy rods, don't know. There's like a Kova lizard, or Koval is a place, I think. So who knows? Who knows? But question, all of this where he's so proud that he uncovered a cabal of corrupt purchasing agents. Did he actually just uncover more tricky maneuvering from the Empire itself for the Death Star project? And did they promote him just to shut him up?
I guess the question there is that something the Empire would do? Would they promote, or would they bury him? And I guess if they're learning Cyril, if anybody who is watching Cyril and cares enough, do they know that if we bury him, it makes him more determined? Right. If we promote him, maybe that satiates his need, because that task has now served its purpose. It's progressed him to this promotion where he can do more digging. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And if it comes back around to that, that would be a beautiful bit of plotting. That would be great.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to bury him last season and that didn't go well.
No, it did not. He got a new uniform out of it.
I liked his closing line to the new guy. There's a future here for those that dare. Like, okay. Okay, hero.
Let's go back to organizing your stationery.
Meanwhile, Dedra is at the Imperial Security Bureau, which is very Nazi-coded. She's much more the action person who's actually affecting the Empire.
I love that. And he's out doing the shopping and the groceries and coming back and doing the stereotypical housewife element of the pairing. So, I love that. I love that spin.
Yeah. And I have to shout out production designer Luke Hall, because just the interiors everywhere are, you know, the interiors, the exteriors, everything is just so spot on and specific and perfect. And I love the way that each person's residence reflects them. You know, Dedra's house is really stark and cold and sharp angles, whereas Chandrila still has like a lot of cold stone, but then in a more earthy way with tree motifs mixed in and circular mm-hmm. patterns and things like that. So just really that's
meticulous. The costuming, the set design, it's everybody involved in production has a story that they can tell. The writers have the more direct way to tell their story. The directors have their way. If you can nail the set design and costuming, that it speaks so strongly. It gives you, it immerses you in the universe so, so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of Chandrila, let's do a little Chandrilan cultural immersion right after a quick break.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So the hangover from the first night celebration is hitting everyone hard, probably Mon Mothma's old friend and ally, Tay Colma, the most, who, according to Perrin, had to be carried home the night before, leaving questions about what kinds of things the inebriated Tay might have been saying. Tay later confronts Mon with what's been bothering him the whole event. He helped her cover her financial tracks. He helped the gangster Davos Skulden wed his son into a respectable family. But what does Tay get? Tay gets his business crippled by rebel activities, and his wife leaves him. He's been drifting closer to Skulden, and who knows what he's thinking. Luthen is starting to see Tay as a loose end that needs to be tied up, which makes Mon very nervous for her old friend. So what did you think of Tay before this set of episodes, and what do you think about him after these first two episodes?
This might be the biggest shift in character over the year. So he was kind of like a bit of a savior in the last mm-hmm. season. It's like, thank goodness Mon has him. This is somebody that is going to fix the biggest problem that she has. He's going to help fix the money problem. And then we dive back in now, and he's the weakest link. He is the biggest point of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And she's been avoiding him. I was a little bit confused about why she's been avoiding him and why she wouldn't keep him close, like given how important he is, because he's one of the few people that knows what she's planning. He's such a key element of the puzzle. I couldn't reconcile in my brain why she was ignoring him.
Yeah, I didn't think she was avoiding him as much as taking him for granted, which right. is a dangerous thing to do. And then, you know, we have to think, when we last season, we had saw this iconic conversation between them where he says like, oh, maybe my politics are a bit too strong for you. And now we find out that he doesn't really believe in the cause at all, at least not so much, you know, as it might inconvenience him or change his mm-hmm. life. He's not going to yeah. go all in. He's not going to give up everything. Like we saw the what was her name? Who Cassian was with in the first episode.
Oh, yeah, the Imperial Guard person mm-hmm. that was changing sides, yeah.
But I guess the difference is also he comes from a lot more money, has a lot more to lose.
Yeah, he seemed to be, while it's successful, he's in on it, and while it's exciting, like, they talk about his bad investments, and it's very, I think it's a great relation to, he maybe saw Mon Mothma and the Rebellion as a good investment, and now he's struggling to see it all the way through because, like, his other investments, they're turning on him. And is this another investment that's going to turn bad? So he's obviously, I believe he seems to have come from money and has this pit that he can invest into, but now it's turning sideways on him and he's losing a lot. And that's where the bravery and the morality to keep fighting sees you through those times. And if you don't have that, then yeah, it's likely that he's going to see the next source of income, his next investment that is safer than the moral cause that Mon Mothma is fighting.
Right. Yeah, and it is, you know, he's blaming the rebel activities, which is what the Empire wants. But of course, it's actually the Empire's crackdowns on rebel activities that are causing the problems. But
yeah,
the Empire wants you to blame the rebels, and so he does. Yeah,
they control the narrative, and I like that. That's the way it's going because it's not. You need to have that element to the story where there are going to be people on either side, and there's going to be people in the middle that are straddling for everyday life. And like, hey, whether it's with the rebels or whether it's with the Empire, as long as you leave me alone, I'll be okay. And I feel like he's right there, and his affection for Mon has drawn him to this point.
Yeah. I loved about the first episode where they had like the Imperial marketing bros. that is, I should admit, I went to business school and those were the people I went to school with.
Oh, my
goodness. I do have a background in marketing. But yeah, one of my favorite movies of this year that I've seen so far is a Dutch documentary called The Propagandist. Mm. And it's about Jan Tonnison and just basically the people who ran the Dutch wing of the propaganda filmmaking during World War II.
Right.
And it's making the rounds at festivals and things like that, The Propagandist. But I had a chill throughout my body the entire time I was watching that movie, because the way that you spread these messages is so insidious and subtle. Yeah. So that people, you know, you can't slap people in the face with it or they will resist. You just give them a little something to blame for their problems. Oh, it's not the Nazis. It's mm-hmm. the Jewish people who are, why are they flaunting their stuff in the city center?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, they're bringing questions. It upon themselves. Why is her skirt so short? She asks for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You have to question why this is happening, not a direct attack. It's just something to think about. I'm just saying, that kind of vibe. And that's really enticing to a certain mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So question, would you want to live on Chandrila?
It's the definition of a nice place to visit, but I would be terrified of touching anything. It's absolutely beautiful. And I love a good hike through a mountain, but it is just exquisite, and I wouldn't know where to sit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the thing, is we are obviously seeing the most wealthy on Chandrila. And my question is, how do the poor live, or does Chandrila even have poor people?
It may be a lowly populated place that is just the height of wealth and opulence.
Yeah, I mean, I know it does become later a center for the government after the Battle of Endor, but it was originally introduced in the book Aftermath in 2015, so it's a relatively recent development. So it's being developed most in Andor, I think, than anywhere else before.
Well, and developed really well. It's absolutely stunning. It already feels like a culture that has been in the Star Wars universe forever, so they're doing a great job with it, and it is perfect to have Tay there, surrounded by this opulence and surrounded by all of this pomp and ceremony. And I can feel Mon Mothma just like, I wish we could tone it down. I know we can't, but there, everything in me is like, this is not appropriate. This is sending the wrong message. She is squirming and fighting in every way, and Genevieve O'Reilly is just, I can't say enough good things about how she is embodying the duality of Mon Mothma, and combined with Stellan Skarsgård, who is just like visibly shifting between Jekyll and Hyde. And you can see it happening. And the pair of them doing that together, opposite each other in the same scene for different reasons. I've got tingles. I want the entire episode to be with them. It's just, it's so, so juicy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that just, you know, I already shouted out the production designer, but I have to shout out also the costume designer, Michael Wilkinson, because they just really bring this to life. Well, he, by the way, he says on a StarWars.com interview, he said that the inspiration that was given to them by Tony Gilroy was Japan meets Scandinavia.
I love that.
Yeah. Both ancient and futuristic feeling, and incredibly refined and ritualized. So yeah, they absolutely nailed that. But I love also with Mon Mothma, feeding into what you're saying, is he says there's always that wonderful balance between what's going on behind the public face. To hint that in her costumes, we always had many layers going on so that she can reveal and conceal.
Oh, I love that so much. Tell your story with the tools that you have. Oh, I love it.
And you see her like rearranging aspects of her clothing as she talks to various people. And
yeah, she moves from crowd to crowd. Oh, it's so good. So, so juicy.
Yeah. Apparently, by the way, also that wedding dress that we see Lita looking at, it took 6 months to make it.
Oh, my goodness.
It's all hand beating and hand finishing. And yeah,
yikes, that is incredible. I hope it gets a little bit of screen time.
Right.
To justify that.
So we talked about Tay and how our feelings are kind of shifting on him. But what about Perrin? What did you think of him before this episode? And what did you think of him after this episode?
Pretty much exactly the same. He is the slime ball we need him to be. He is the product of the system that is quite happy to live in it. And while he might protest a little bit with some hurt pride about maybe Mon Mothma is daring to have an affair and perhaps be happy, because he refuses to see it as anything deeper than that. It's just, oh, you're just chasing after some old flame. But he is, for me, it just seems to be somebody that's quite happy in the system that favors him and other men. And his speech at the end is very telling. The angle that he's saying it from, it's just like, it was sending my mind through roller coasters, because it was kind of gaslighting, but kind of like, he isn't smart enough to deliberately gaslight someone. Like, it is just inbuilt inside him, and his angle is find the joy because it won't come often. Yeah, because of you. You're the reason the joy is missing. So it's, I think he's just, I would be amazed if anything more is done with him other than just the man who is perpetuating the opulence and the tradition and just living his lovely, lovely life with nice meals.
All right. So just to recap that section, Mon's husband, Perrin, meanwhile, when not accusing his wife of cheating on him with Tay, for whom he has nothing but disdain, is giving touching wedding toasts that reach his daughter Lita's soul, apparently more than Mon's guilt at sticking her in a loveless marriage that seems too much like her own.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read that speech that Perrin gives at the end?
Oh, I feel dirty, but yes, I will. Trouble and disagreement arrive without summons. There's no choice in this. There's no effort required. You simply stand still and the galaxy will deliver a daily basket of fresh anxieties to your door without fail. He's not wrong.
No.
My hope is that you learn to reach past this constant cloud of sadness. Pleasure, gaiety, amusement. These are the hidden things, the music buried beneath all that noise. Joy, joy, joy. But joy has no wind at its back. Joy will not announce its arrival. You need to listen for it and be mindful of how fleeting and delicate it can be. But search out these treasures. A moment of pleasing sensation. The memory of laughter and good company. The comfort of a fine meal. And for me right now, it's the smile that I can't hide as I see these two young people sharing our greatest tradition. Like, nobody looks happy. No one looks happy, sir. Just be grateful you're drunk.
Lita looked happy because she's filling what she thinks is her role that marks her as a successful young woman. And by young woman, let's emphasize again, 14.
14.
Yeah.
Young child.
It's a great speech, and he's not wrong.
No, he's not wrong. He's not wrong from his perspective, absolutely. It's this is what I couldn't get out of my brain, was like, all of the words are right, but I hate them. Mm. Like, and I can't remember if it's this episode or episode one where Leda has the realization that he won't hold her hand. Is that in this episode?
It's this one. Yeah.
And that's the first tweak of sadness that we see from her, and the realization that this isn't going to be a Disney wedding. This isn't going to be the happy ever after that she might think it is. And I'm glad we had that. She's not just blindly indoctrinated. There is some emotion there where she is not happy. And, oh man, Mon can just see, if you're concerned that he won't hold your hand now, my goodness, have you got decades of adjustment ahead of you.
I really teared up the first time I watched her say to Leda in that moment, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Because she knows what she's in for. She's like, you know, this, it's going to be a marriage like mine. But question about, what do you think is the situation with Mon and Perrin? Because it seems like it's very do as thou wilt. Or do you think there's like hypocrisy there in that? Because he's questioning her about Tay. I don't think she's had an affair with Tay. It's obviously, they're talking about the rebellion. That's why they're always whispering together. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there is a romance there, but I also wouldn't discount that Mon would do that and would pursue that for herself. I think, and I'm not married, but I have married friends, and I feel like there is an element of, if you are committed to somebody for the long haul and you're decades and decades and decades together, you find out it's not the pairing that you once believed it was. There are two options. You can make the hard choice and separate and do the really hard thing of finding a new life, or you find happiness in the ways that you can. And I feel like the pair of them don't have the option to be apart from each other, so they find happiness in the ways that they can, which is why Perrin digs, but doesn't dig that deep. There isn't like this big private outburst of, you're cheating on me. It's very casual the way he says it. Almost, if she admitted to it, he would be like, cool, just wanted you to admit it to me and just be honest. So I feel like she keeps him very, very separate and just finds convenience and happiness where she can in that relationship.
Yeah, it does sound like they sounded last season as though they started out in a place where they did like each other, and she called him like a young firebrand, and where did that pairing go? I'm hoping maybe for Leda, because it looks grim at the start, maybe they'll discover it was just that indeed her husband just needs to grow up, and maybe he will be a good husband. That's my hope. As far as Perrin and Mon, I have to say I can't remember who, but someone mentioned that I would learn a lot more about their relationship that might shift my opinion of Perrin in Reign of the Empire, The Mask of Fear. And I've only just started that book. I've only read a couple Mon chapters. I'm already starting to get the idea that, yeah, it's not like she's blameless in everything. If he has suspicions, maybe it has something to do with the past, but I have to admit, I put that book aside for the moment so that I can reread some Night Sister books before before Tales of the Underworld comes out May 4th.
Amazing.
Because Ventress is my favorite. but it's funny that Tay is talking about the gossiping biddies and like, oh, the gossiping biddies didn't get to Mon. But I guess Perrin is one of the gossiping biddies, because he certainly knows all the tea. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. He is so happy to dish the dirt that Tay was absolutely drunk. And for a second there, I was like, what did he hear? And that tension building is so, so great, because Perrin is such a potentially dangerous person to have overheard Tay say something or moan about something that he shouldn't be moaning about. So, and you can see that on Mon's face, like it drops completely. And is the damage already done? And even if it isn't done, oh no, what next? Because we've got days of drinking ahead of us.
Yeah, it is funny that as Perrin is judging Tay, he's also drinking himself.
Oh, of course. Yeah. He is
But he's thinking, like, at least I'm clean about it. I'm not messy.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what he could admit that people wouldn't already know. Like, he seems kind of untouchable in his obliviousness to what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. The wedding hike, though, that whole thing sounded like fun. You said you're not married. If you were, would you incorporate a wedding hike tradition?
Yeah, I'd love a good hike. And I think if the person I was marrying didn't, then that's an important
thing
to know.
Yeah.
it wouldn't be a problem, but it's an important thing to know. I think that could, you could find out a lot about each other by taking a very long, multi-hour draining hike.
That's true.
If you can survive
just
that.
Even preparing for such a hike, you start to learn whether that person has experienced it before.
Exactly. But no, it looked beautiful, that big old Disney green screen lab virtual reality studio thing that they have is just fantastic.
Hey, editor Alicia here, just to interject that the Chandrillon hike scene actually was filmed on location in Montserrat, Spain. So that's why it looks so gorgeous. All right, back to the conversation. But I do like, and I suppose this comes from the Scandinavian side, where this culture in Chandrilla is part outdoorsy, like let's go for a hike, and then part, you know, let's party in a marble palace.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. It's a party I'd like to go to.
Yes. I like what's old is new. It's been so long since I've done this hike that Vel doesn't even seem to remember what the tradition entails, which is to hike together to the top of the mountain where they gaze out across their ancestral lands as a choir of children sing and the elders purify them. And I had to giggle with the choir of children, but that's just because of Daredevil. So people who watch this season of Daredevil know why I'm laughing.
I haven't got there yet.
Mm-hmm. There's a very funny moment with the choir of children.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's I kind of love that she said I don't remember the function of it, because it kind of sums up that the wedding ceremony, the tradition can be anything. It could be any obscure thing that has been passed down over time, and it's not. It kind of like I'm probably reading way too much into it, but it reflects why this wedding is. How she views this wedding in general. Like, what's the point of this tradition when the wedding itself is just a function for me to pursue this other goal that I have?
Yeah. But I guess I can see why her daughter likes it, because since her daughter is some sort of, I don't know, it almost feels like they're nobility. She gets pure maids, which are basically like ladies in waiting.
Oh, I'm sure she's absolutely. I mean, I don't know many 14-year-olds that wouldn't absolutely enjoy that.
A bunch of girls who have to follow you around and ooh and ah at your dress and everything you do. Yeah. She's like, Mom, I don't want to give this up. What are you talking about?
Can I be engaged forever?
Yeah. I wonder if she gets to keep the pure maids. I guess not. Yeah, probably. Probably that's weird once you get married.
I think it's downhill from here.
Yeah. Oh, but we also got, since I brought up Vel, we also got mention of Cinta, her girlfriend, who said, we have to put the struggle first last season. Mm. And apparently they haven't been in touch for months. And she says, if she wanted to see me, she would. It was never going to be perfect or good. Bad timing. Do you think there's any reality in which Cinta and Vel make it?
Not if I'm writing the show. I think they are set up to be tragically motivated by one another's death at some point. I think that has got to, it would be beautiful if they could make it, but it is not in keeping with what we know about Star Wars and this Rogue One Andor story in particular. It's very much a tragic story of giving everything to the cause.
I hope at least some characters make it okay. I mean, we know Mon obviously survived. She's around for a long time after this.
Yeah.
Do you think also, so I noticed in episode one, there was a moment between Vel and Clea that made me wonder. Did you notice that as well? Or do you
No, I didn't. My oblivious membrane missed it.
I mean, I'm not saying it's there, although other people in the Discord did also see it. There's like a moment where Clea says to Vel, just two single women surveying the prospects, and Vel gives her like this look up and down and walks away.
Oh, I remember that now. Yes.
Maybe reading into it, maybe there's Cinta's got a, it's going to get a run for her money from someone who has more time for Vel.
Well, that would be one of the more interesting love triangles that I've ever seen, to be honest. Like, it tends to be pretty tedious. But now I'd be all in for that. I think at this point it's probably reading a bit too much, but it's interesting because, like, how committed can you be when you're literally separated by galaxies and wars and rebellions? Like, there are other priorities.
Yeah. If you just don't spend time together, then what does that make you if you don't have any contact at all? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, speaking, the reason why they don't have any contact, Luthen is really at the event because of his day job. Father of the groom, Davos Skolden, has bought the bride's family a very expensive historical gift, a Chandri Merle statue. His assistant, Clea, is with him, but she's growing increasingly nervous that they haven't heard anything from Cassian since he left Sinar with a TIE Avenger prototype last week. And they can't reach Bix either, as the Empire has blocked all comms to the planet of Mina Rao while they conduct an Imperial inspection. Clea decides to go back to the shop on Coruscant, where she has a full comms system to try to find out what's going on. So the Chandri Merle, that statue, they talk about it more in episode 3. So there'll be more background in that episode. I will say for now, it's 25,000 years old and it's tied to an important historical event that actually this week's Holocron Lorecast is going to be about, the galactic invasion behind the stealing of this statue.
Oh, that's fun. Love that. Yeah, I have no idea. That was like, whatever you've put underneath that blanket, it could be a DeLorean for all I know. Didn't have a clue, but it seemed important.
Yeah, yeah. Stay tuned for episode 3 and the Holocron. So did you notice Perrin watching Luthen and Clea talk? Do you think Perrin, what do you think he's up to? Is he on anybody's side? Is he just taking in information? Is he working with anybody?
I feel like it's curiosity. I feel like he's actually a very bored man because he quite literally has everything. And I think his day-to-day life is probably fairly isolated if he's just kind of in his ivory tower. Now he has an opportunity where the entire galaxy has come to him. And I can't imagine how he wouldn't be intrigued and interested. And just using that, I think it's more power than anything. I can't imagine, maybe he's on Mon's side, if anyone, but I just think he likes the power, and I think he likes to be in the know. And he's one of the gossiping cluck, cluck, cluck people.
The bitties, yeah.
Exactly. So I think he is just trying to gather as much tea as possible for his own amusement.
Be interesting to see where things stand when they jump forward a year next week. About Mon's storyline next week, though, I'm really hoping that she returns to the Senate, because that is the year where canonically she meets the soon-to-be youngest senator ever, Leia Organa. So
that'll be fascinating.
I'm putting on my clown makeup and I'm holding my breath that they have recast Leia and we're going to meet her next week. Please, 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 please. Oh, that would be incredible.
I would love that.
There are people, and just to say, by the way, Mon joined the Senate at 18, so Leia must have been younger, and she would be 15 as of the year this week takes place, 16 next right. year. So,
and how many years after Obi-Wan is that?
Let's see. Obi-Wan, I think she was like 8.
That sounds right.
Yeah. So I'm hoping, you know, there are people who are like, oh, I don't want the main characters to show up. I'm like, they chose to put this story to in this part of the timeline, which is an extremely important part for Leia's of Leia's story, so they have to at least mention her. But
yeah, I don't understand why she wouldn't be there. She is like, Rogue One is the build up to the first Star Wars movie, which I believe Leia is in. So I don't understand why adding that extra texture of having Leia there and how she's incorporated into this. I don't really see a downside to that. It's not like a cameo where it's like, oh, what's Jar Jar doing at this time? Like, obviously, but this is integral to the story. This makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's a key moment for both Leia, and she is a key person in Mon Mothma's life because of, you know, their Senate connections and the fact that Mon has been working with Leia's father, Bail Organa. I'm also hoping he shows up next week. That would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll see how that goes. All right, this is a good spot to take another break, and when we get back, we'll talk about the other two storylines. We'll check in first with Bix and then with Cassian. See you in a sec. All right, let's switch our focus to the Tulis on the Lam. The Empire holds the agricultural planet of Mina Rao hostage. They say to audit the harvesting of their essential grains, but their actions seem to solely be geared on rooting out illegal immigrants who arrive on the planet to help with the annual grain harvest. Illegal immigrants, which currently include Ferex refugees Bix, Brasso, and Wilman. Luckily, the trio have local allies. Brasso has set up a household with local woman Talia, and the operators of the local general store, Kellen and Aneth, are on their side as well, even if Aneth doesn't really approve of Will's budding romance with her daughter, Bila. And I just want to point out that B2 Emo has a friend. The subtitles called him AGR9, which I guess is like an agricultural droid. But I love B2 Emo having a friend.
I love it so much. I'm just running around living his best stuttery life. He's such a joy.
Even if he's waiting for Cassian, he at least has someone to while the time with.
Exactly. Just adorable. I think it says so much about our ability to relate to the droids more than the humans sometimes.
Well, it's like I often like animals better than people. So
absolutely. Yeah. Very similar.
Yeah, this is one of those places where this show is really touching on our real world where, you know, the Empire wants the illegals gone, but also wants grain production up. So these are conflicting goals, you know, which is more important to you.
Exactly. Is it a stealing jobs thing? Because guess what? Not many people were wanting those jobs. So what exactly is being stolen? It's very interesting. Like they mention visas by name. Like, do you have the right visas? Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, this was written before some of the more current U.S. events that are happening, but it is so anxiety-filling to watch this, to see how closely emulating it is real life. This is where I feel the most anxiety in the whole episode, because it reminds me of the beginning to Inglourious Basterds, where you have the German general, whoever, coming round trying to find the Jewish family that are hidden in the floorboards. Mm-hmm. It's that deliberately, it is that feel of, where do we go next to be hidden? If we are found, how can we talk our way out of it? Like, it, and they're waiting. They can't leave the planet because they're waiting for Cassian. And the waiting is horrible. I can't remember if it's episode one or two, but somebody says, we will, I think Brasso says, we'll know more tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that's just like, oh, great. So now you sleep well tonight, guys. And it's just that waiting and not know. Are you waiting for nothing to happen? Are you waiting for the worst day of your life? Like, it's prescient and terrifying.
Yeah. Also, especially because these troops, they're so capricious about, you know, they'll punish some, let others slide. All right, well, let's get into the creepiest thing that happens this episode.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The group monitors the activities of the Imperials, planning how to maneuver should attention swing to their council sector. But they're already being visited by random patrols who make their entitlement known in Kellen and Aneth's store. Meanwhile, the leader of this patrol, a Lieutenant Kroll, corners Bix, who is going by the name Zala, in a grain silo. He tries to pressure her into joining him for a dinner date in the local city of the Rao, but she declines, saying she is married, though her husband is off-planet for a few days. He eventually leaves, but not before making Bix and the audience at home very uncomfortable.
Yeah. A very familiar story with these regimes. Like, there's plenty of stories from World War II of Nazi soldiers taking partners and taking women. And it's another nod towards the imperialistic fascist side of the equation. It definitely nails the creep.
Yeah. It is funny. I like to see this, that they're messing around with the real world association. So obviously people often wonder, is the Empire the Nazis? Well, actually it was the first movie was a response to Vietnam. So I'll let you, let you figure out who the Empire is then. But they are using like German words for objects on this planet of Mina Rao.
Yeah.
So for instance, like the house that they're living in, it's called a mobile house, MOBIL-HAUS, which is a German spelling. And also the Mina Rao. So it's called, I just saw the name written down. We see this animal, this like kind of yak like animal in the background, who's, by the way, operated by two puppeteers, apparently. Practical, amazing. Yeah. But it's called, I saw it written down. I'm like, is that the beer beast or the buyer beast? And then I'm like, no, German. It's the beer beast. It's the beer beast. B-I-E-R.
Oh, that's amazing.
But you also see how this planet has been relatively sheltered. You see a child playing with an AT-ST puppet because they just see these things as toys, whereas an AT-ST walker would scare anyone who's encountered one.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a toy, yeah.
One of the most baffling things to me is how willing we are to let our kids play with guns. And it's so normal. It is in every toy shop, every Walmart, there will be an aisle filled with guns. And yeah, take from that insidious propaganda what you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And the talk about freezing the zone during the audit to prevent things from sneaking away. Like, so anxious. Crawl guy.
And the one consistent, like you talked about, the arbitrary nature of who's being arrested, who's being taken away. The only consistent thing is that anybody who runs is immediately being taken. So their one, like, this could work, is the one thing that is guaranteed to get them caught. So they are, the show did a great way of explaining to us why this is their only option, to sit and wait. And it didn't feel like contrived to me. It felt very, very too real.
Yeah. Yeah, and you also have to wonder, like, what sort of mental condition are these individual troopers in? We hear the soldiers asking in the shop for pisos, and we also heard pisos in this first season where Cassian's overnight date asked about pisos, and they are a mild stimulant.
So, good catch.
Are these soldiers working long hours and overtired and maybe not making the most soundest judgments? That's not an excuse for Kroll, but just saying in general.
No, but it is an exacerbating factor. Like, it is going to amplify those intrusive thoughts that he probably has. And while stimulated or drugged, one or the other, it makes you more malleable and more, the inhibitions lower.
Yeah, and quicker to anger, for sure.
Mm.
Another production design note, just really cool. Just going to read directly from this interview on StarWars.com. The fields of Mina Rao were an ancient rye planted specifically for Andor Season 2 in Watlingen, Oxfordshire, and it took a full year to grow. Due to the SAG-AFTRA strikes of 2023, the crop had to be harvested and placed in sheets of polystyrene by the Greens team, allowing the outdoor location sets to be reconstructed on Pinewood's 007 stage in early 2024. So they grew this entire field of wheat over a year, and then had to pack it up and take it to a soundstage.
Oh, no. That's incredibly ironic that you wanted to make this as natural as possible, and you've made this natural thing that you've now had to make artificial. That's incredible. I love that commitment. That's amazing.
And I love how they just seed background details of this world without calling too much attention. Like, we see, I think this is in the first episode, we see a sort of mound of earth labeled 436. So we know, we hear them continuously referring to the 400. So 436 would be in the 400, and they're referring to the 800. Quote unquote, Zala, actually Bix, says they're based in 207. I don't know if she was lying to him at that moment or if they really are based in 207, but that would mean they're in the 200.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that's a lie, but it feels like a risky one as well.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
maybe
that.
It's a truth. What do you think of Will and Bila? Total Romeo and Juliet vibes.
Yeah, I think it's just about kind of which one dies and in what which order.
She makes him promise to say goodbye if he has to go. And I'm like, that's going to go well.
I mean, if you wanted to make sure he doesn't die, then why did you say that? You've just absolutely signed his death warrant. yeah, I think that is the most doomedest doomed relationship to ever doom its way in front of us.
Hmm.
But it's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's sweet. I would love to see it be a happy ending somewhere. I'm hoping. Give us some happy endings, Tony.
Give us one. Give us one happy ending.
Give us one happy ending. Give us some young happy people, at least. I don't know.
We want Luke's out there being happy.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll hold on to that.
I mean, Rogue One ends in such a sad note, so.
I mean, yeah, it's the tone, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, any happiness you have now, like, every single episode, I have to remind myself of Cassian's ending. And it's beautiful. I think it's just so clever to have this prequel series exist.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's turn our attention to the final location.
If we have to.
Everybody's favorite, in the jungles where there's Rochambeau, Rassic rules. The Maya Pai Brigade is now divided into two feuding factions. One has control of the TIE Avenger prototype Cassian Andor liberated last week, which is a fighter with guns on the front, and the other holds Cassian Andor himself, the only pilot there who can fly the TIE Avenger. He's a hostage on their broken-down jalopy, which boasts luxurious amenities like a handful of protein bars, even some that don't have mold on them.
I would argue the moldy ones are better for you.
Extra, at least they might, you might hallucinate and that'll make it more fun.
Exactly.
As the two factions fight each other, the group with the TIE Avenger is trying to turn the ship so that it can shoot the others, never mind that it will take out the pilots. And then the groups are also each surreptitiously scouting the jungle where members of their party are disappearing to a roaring beast in the night. The anxieties eventually escalate to a winner-takes-all round of five hands, a sort of Star Wars rock-paper-scissors. Using this distraction, and the additional distraction that follows, when one of these growling beasts, Dudars, charges out of the jungle to gobble up a couple more Maya Pai Brigaders, Cassian breaks free and takes off in the TIE Avenger, leaving the Maya Pai Brigade... Jesus. Leaving the Maya Pai Brigade behind.
They did that to you.
As he pulls above the tree line, ancient temples are visible, set against the backdrop of a giant gas planet. This is the moon known as Yavin 4, which in a few short years will be the primary base of the Rebel Alliance. Anyway.
That's the reason to be there, for sure.
I love Sub-Zero called these, I think it was Sub-Zero, called them the Lord of the Flies Rebels, and now I can't think of them differently.
Oh, it really is. Obviously, I've pulled up IMDb. So some of the names we've got. Fleck, Gerdus, Plug, Snur, Nazi, Bardi.
Oh, yeah, now, here. I have them.
Neek.
Yeah, I wrote in the notes. So there's only two in the holocron, which is like a thing on Star Wars. On StarWars.com, they have a holocron where they'll put like lore nuggets and stuff. And oh, so amazing. They... including a bunch of characters, and there's only two listed on there, and that's the leaders of the two different groups. So on the one side, we have Gerdus, who's the one holding Cassian hostage, and he's actually, his name's Sam Gilroy, and he's Tony Gilroy's son.
Oh, that's amazing. That's fun. Nepotism for the win.
I mean, if it works, it works.
Yeah, absolutely.
At least he's qualified. And then, his... team was the ones I caught as many names as I could. His team was Crab is the one whose foot was found, RIP Crab. And then there was Fleck, Baso, Plug, Snee, and Snur.
That's amazing.
And then the other leader is Bardi, and he's played by Benjamin Norris. And it was driving me crazy why he looked familiar. He's in a bunch of stuff, but I recognize him personally from Abbott Elementary.
Oh, that's fun. That's a show we need to get to.
Yeah, I definitely recommend Abbott Elementary. Much cheerier than this one.
It's a low bar.
Even though it's about struggles of public schooling. but he's the one that they said, he's leading the group that has the fighter ship, but also he's the one who says his brother just left to get search for survivors, and the others think that he just left them all behind.
Abandoned them, yeah.
What do you think?
I don't care.
You don't care? I think he's going to be back. I think he's going to be back. And, and the rest of their group is Raud, Tick, Nazi, and Rika died in the jungle.
Yeah. Rest in pieces. Yeah, it's I had to rewatch the scene a few times because between the shouting across the forest to each other, like I couldn't understand why they were suddenly doing rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock. And I had to like rewind it, like, what did I miss here? Because they're making an agreement of some sort. I do actually kind of enjoy the humor, as ridiculous as it is, because it feels like there's obviously bring forward your second and bring forward your second, and they're going to fight on our behalf. But no, it's to do a four-way, Rochambeau thing. So I appreciate the humor of that. It just, I can't get out of my head the stuck in the mudness of it all. While we're talking about names, though, I refuse to believe that that monster is called a doodah. There is no way you see that thing and go, it's going to eat me, it's a doodah. Like, that didn't happen.
Well, apparently it's named after the designer, Alexander Doodar. So the monster's D-O-O-D-A-R, and the guy is D-U-D-A-R. But that's why it has that name, yeah.
Okay. There had to be something behind it.
And it has like a hippo-like basis.
That makes sense. Yeah, I'll buy it. But for me, the presence and the appearance of the monster is the most damning indictment of this portion of the episode, because when you introduce a beast in the forest, some secret nasty, it's to build tension and it's to bring in some kind of threat, some kind of catalyst. And I can almost imagine them being around the writer's table and be like, man, this sucks. What should we do? Let's put a monster in the forest. Like, it's kind of telling for me that it needed a monster, and the conflict between the two rebel factions wasn't enough. There wasn't enough tension there. You had to add something else in. So yeah, it's the only bit that doesn't really sing for me.
Yeah. So the funny aspect of it was born of a dinner where Tony Gilroy was having dinner with his son and with the actor who plays Barty. And the two younger guys, I mean, we should say younger guys, they're like our age. They're like 30s or so.
They act young.
Yeah, they act young. But they were, and I guess they act young in real life, which, you know, they're fun, I guess. But they were doing some sort of rock, paper, scissor thing at the dinner table. And Tony Gilroy started to think like, yeah, we need to add a little bit more levity. Maybe, you know, because obviously he wants to show the infighting, bickering and things like that. But
yeah,
I do think that they are laying important groundwork. I'm expecting to continue to play out because of two things. First of all, the fact that it's revealed at the end of this episode that they're actually on Yavin 4, the moon Yavin 4, which is going to be... So we talked about the timeline and the fact that this is set in 4BBY, and Y is for Yavin, and that's because, yeah, this is going to be the rebel base, the main rebel base by the time of the main movie. So in a few short years, this planet they're stranded on is going to be the main rebel base. So what they're suggesting right now is that this group is probably one of the founders.
It's very cool. And I do, like, if I'm taking a step back from some frustration, it is doing something important, which is showing how this fledgling rebellion is its own worst enemy. And it's the advantage of having a rebellion that works in cells that are independent from each other and communicate carefully is that, I mean, the advantage is that when one is taken out, the others can still function. Like, if one is uncovered, then it's not going to put the entire rebellion at risk. But the downside is that that separation brings its own hierarchy, its own leadership. And then by human nature, that breeds arguments as well. So its lack of unity is its strength and its weakness. And that is, like, probably shown here more than we've seen anywhere else, where they literally devolve into a civil war between the 15 of them.
Yeah. Well, so, okay. And the other thing, second reason why I think this might play out is actually, this was a tip off from the recap, you know, the previously on at the beginning of the episode. They show Dedra from episode one saying to Krennic, you need Gorman rebels you can depend on to do the wrong thing. And they intercut that with clips of this crew.
Oh, it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. Yeah, absolutely. That infighting is crucial to the Empire. Like, they depend on it.
But should all strife be decided with Rochambeau or rock, paper, scissors, depending on where you grew up?
I feel like you're leading me into an answer here.
Should it, and why is the answer yes?
Exactly. If all else is, if democracy has completely failed, I want to see Mon Mothma doing rock, paper, scissors at some point in the Senate.
Well, they say there's a rumor that the reason why people call it Rochambeau is it dates back to like some epic rock, paper, scissors event between George Washington and the 18th century Comte de Rochambeau. But that's probably not true, actually.
I'll believe it.
Probably a Japanese hand game. Yeah. But they did actually, Tony Gilroy and the two lads, as we'll call them, even though they're grown-ass men, they invented all the rules for this five hands. There's a full version with 15 animal gestures, including a rancor, snork, and snooze bird, which are, they have two players in three rounds overseen by referee. But we saw a variation, a shortened variation with the four people, the 2 seconds, that's called the Roski rules.
Just the amount of lore that just went into that was incredible. I feel bad for mocking it now.
I mean, Cassian is definitely thinking the worst of them. He's like, hey, do you want to gather rainwater? Like, it's almost like he feels bad for them. It's like barely even self-protection. It's like, you know, maybe you want to set a perimeter.
Be raining forever. Do you want to get that top? It's like he's you can kind of hear him thinking, what have I got myself into? Like, we are in so much trouble.
Yeah, I do wonder. We hear Snee, one of the people, say Ichuta, which is a Huttese curse, first heard in The Empire Strikes Back. So we've got to wonder, does this group have underworld links, because Huttese is often used amongst people who are smugglers and you know, people who work
that's
in
great.
The underworld.
I love that. That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I wonder. Okay, important survival question though. Would you eat those melons? You say no before I ask.
I mean, it depends. If we're talking about day 14 of hunger, yeah, I'm eating it. I don't know if I'm there yet on day 3.
But it's also, they did such a good job with, we can't smell the melons, obviously, but they portrayed how stinking they are. And just like that petrid looking juice that was slopping out of them. Just, I was gagging.
Yeah.
Gagging just watching.
I've been watching the, because apparently there's not enough on TV for me to watch. I've been watching the early seasons of Survivor, going all the way back to season 1. And they used to do these eating trials, and they're the bits that I skip. I don't need to see people eating horrible things and then vomiting. Yeah.
No, and that's also why I never wanted to do Fear Factor. Like, I have no problem with the, like, swim with a shark and walk across a balance beam up in the air. I'll do all that. Eat, you know, this 500-year-old poo or whatever. Like, no, thank you. thank you.
The elephant can keep its testicles. I do not want to eat them. Thank you.
Yeah. And the one person says to the other, you ate those trogs, which I tried looking it up, and I don't think trogs are a real thing in Star Wars yet, but I love that Star Wars does this. It just drops these words, and then people are like, what are trogs? And then some other writer gets to come back later and be like,
exactly.
Here's the entire ecosystem of the trogs.
they've got a hierarchy and a monarchy among themselves. They're going to be key to the rebellion at some point. There's going to be a big... The Trog insurrection of 14 BBY.
Well, speaking of hierarchies, I do Maya Pai. Why do I have so much trouble saying her name? Maya Pai is presumed dead, but I kind of hope she's not, because these people, she seems like she's much more on top of it and they fall apart without her.
Yeah, me too. I think that would be a great... I don't know how quickly we're going to return to Yavin, but I feel like it'll be with her, like, taking them to task and being like, so what exactly happened while I wasn't here? And they have to recount this ridiculous story, and she just lambasts them for their incompetence.
Yeah.
I hope. Be a post-credit scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Please give us a post-credit scene. I love them. But yeah, it just goes to show you how a lot of groups fall apart when they have a charismatic leader who keeps them all together. And when that leader is gone, if you don't have a next leader in line who can pull all the different groups, you know, all the different interests toward each other, mm-hmm. that it just falls apart.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, did you have any other thoughts on this second episode of Andor or the start of the season in general?
No, I think it's a really, really strong start. Stuck in the mudness aside, I am. Mm-hmm. I've watched episode 3. I'm excited, beyond excited, for the next 3 episodes. I actually kind of like this format. I think it's pretty, whatever reason there is behind it and how it affects podcast scheduling aside, it is novel and it is, they've kind of made the bug the feature. So this intentional year jump between batches of 3 is a really cool way to tell this story. And it's something I haven't really seen before in TV. Knowing that there's an end in sight really, really helps you make a cohesive, complete story. So yeah, it's bittersweet because I want to know what the next Andor is going to be. I want to know what the next incredible appointment TV is going to come from Star Wars next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm really hoping, and we're going to talk about this in the Holocron Lorecast this week. I'm really hoping that they're also setting up some plot points for the wider history here, like that whole statue. I'm hoping that the events around that will show up in the Dawn of the Jedi movie that James Mangold's been working on.
Yes.
So I feel like they're going in a good direction as long as they don't doubt themselves and listen to people and cancel the Acolyte. Please give me back the Acolyte. But also please give me more of this.
Yeah, also this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Give things room to breathe. How about you just give things 3 seasons, like as a minimum, like let's be controversial and give some things some room to breathe, because if you cancel Star Trek The Next Generation after season 1, which you would have been justified to do, you don't get the awesomeness that comes later. So yeah, it's hard landscape.
Yeah, and I say if you're going to cancel something, at least give them a wrap-up movie.
Yeah, give them something. Yeah, I mean, one of the only good decisions they made with Firefly was to give them that opportunity. Just let them do something.
Fine, but it took a while. It took a while, I have to say. Yeah, so sure I'm holding my breath. So please at least give us an Acolyte wrap-up movie where we see not Palpatine. Plagueis, yeah. I had to think in my mind. I'm like, the tale of Darth Plagueis the Wise, yes. Give me Darth Plagueis and Yoda fighting. Give me,
It's just
I'm glad that Tony Gilroy, and this, you know, has to do with he's proven himself and he has a lot of cachet in the entertainment industry. I'm glad he was able to set his own terms of this is how I want to do the show and tell a complete story my way. And without me and Diego Luna becoming grandpas on the job, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. dragging it out. I remember, he said in an interview somewhere, he's actually relieved they didn't have to do the full 5 seasons they had planned, because that's a huge, huge commitment. It's interesting times.
Well, can't wait to hear it. And looking forward to talking about episode, 5 with you next week.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
And do you want to tell people about the Captain's Pod?
Yeah, so Captain's Pod is my home for podcasting. Just search for Captain's Pod, a Star Trek companion, wherever you cast your pods and such, and we are on a brief break at the minute until Strange New Worlds season 3 comes back, but we're going to be putting up our coverage of Strange New Worlds season 2 as a bit of a recap. So ahead of that coming out, you can listen to what myself and my co-host Danae, who is a relapsed Star Trek fan who I'm trying to bring back into the fold, what we thought of Strange New Worlds season 2. But yeah, we've covered a plethora of Star Trek episodes. I'm just trying to find the episodes that are going to hook her back in. So we've just finished a season of what fans believe are the best episodes of Star Trek. They're comfort food for Star Trek. So quite a wide variety of episodes in there.
And didn't you say you're doing the worst episodes now? So giving the full spectrum?
Yeah, we are working on that season now. We're going to try and squeeze that in before Strange New Worlds comes out. But if not, that'll be what we're doing after Strange New Worlds. And that is the what fans believe the worst, more controversial episodes of Star Trek are. Just to give everyone the full experience.
All right. Excellent. Well, I'll let you go for now, Ian. Looking forward to talking to you next week. Listeners, stick around for more information about how this coverage of Andor is going to work and what else is going on in the network in the meantime. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you again to Ian, and watch out for the episode 3 breakdown coming out from the Delta Squadron next in the same feed. Subscribers, you'll get more Andor content this week as well, including at least the Holocron Lorecast. This week it's going to be about the Rakatan invaders and why they're important for this and other upcoming Star Wars storytelling. And also, of course, you get the additional weekly Rebel Squadron radio mini briefings, and watch out for other audio and visual extras. If you only want these Andor extras, plus all the other public Andor episodes from this season and last ad-free, then you can unlock your own private Andor extras listening list for a one-time price of $10. But monthly Supercast and Patreon subscribers will automatically get access to all of that, plus all the extras for Wheel of Time, Severance, Rings of Power, etc., not to mention the regular extra extras like the monthly 11Z's Movie Club. This month, we're going to be talking about Oscar-winning, but not Oscar-winning enough, in my opinion, a real pain. And it won't only be Andor on the public feed this month either. We just wrapped the Wheel of Time. There's still a mailbag episode coming for that. We just wrapped Daredevil Born Again Season 1. There's ongoing The Last of Us weekly coverage and Doctor Who coverage and other regular series and one-shots also in the works, so stay tuned. Not to mention everything that's going on in the other affiliate feeds in the network. Never mind the music is putting out regular episodes talking about the intersection of psychology and music. Definitely go check that one out. I'm sure you'll find a song that catches your attention, but you'll have an interesting time even if you're not into the song. You'll appreciate new things about it and about how the human brain works. Radioactive Ramblings, they've been busy with Ghibli, they've been busy with some other animated series I think are in the works as well. I don't want to promise things for them, but stay tuned there. My own Will Shift Dust will be picking back up with Dune shortly, the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast in the High Republic. Rings and Rituals will be breaking down in the not-so-distant future Season 2 of Rings of Power from the perspective of Rituals. And Properly Howard will be beginning a new movie review season. So you'll find links to all this stuff in the show notes in the link tree. And you'll also find the show notes, the email address, andor@thelorehounds.com, where you can send all your thoughts about the show for discussion on the pod. Please do also join our Discord discussion, where there's a special dedicated forum for Star Wars coverage, including channels per episode for Andor, so that you can discuss the episodes at your own pace. Okay, now the episode's not complete until we shout out our special extra thank yous to the people who make our network a better place to hang. Thank you to our Discord server boosters, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, Doove71, Athena Agilea, Tina, Lestu, Nancy M, Ghost of Perdition, Radioactive Richard. And thank you to all of our subscribers especially, but most of all to our highest tier, the Lore Masters, Samartian, Michael G, Michelle E, Brian P, SC, Peter OH, Adam S, Nancy M, Doove71, Brian8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Matthew M, Sarah M, Andra B, Kwong Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Sub-Zero, Aaron K, Dali V, Mothership61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Lestu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Carly S, Ilmariel, /Tim, and always last, Adrian. And thank you just so much to all of you who are listening. If you're enjoying our Andor coverage, please do share it with the other Andor fans in your life and everyone who should be Andor fans. And okay, that's Echo Squadron out. Delta Squadron, you're up.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. And connect with us on Twitter at @thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, The Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your six.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear three full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.